My name's David Halifax. I'm the head of retail sales for Schroders. And on behalf of Schroders, we'd like to send a very warm welcome to you all with the PC Forum and also to today's session. Our presentation today is titled A Fundamental View of Risk Within Small Cap Portfolios. And our speaker today is David Wannis, who's our portfolio manager for our Australian Equities Smaller Companies Fund. If you start to think about the way portfolio risk is actually assessed and measured or managed within small cap portfolios, traditionally it's very much a quant style analysis. And I suppose what I mean by that is in regards to really sort of using historical price volatility, share price volatility, along with correlation data, and actually putting that through to an index-based type model. I suppose the objective here is really to provide a best guess estimate to future risk. And we sort of, when we're talking about risk in regards to measuring risk, we're really sort of talking about tracking error. And a lot of sort of tracking errors obviously traditionally is ex-ante tracking error. So today, what Dave is actually going to introduce or present on is introducing, I suppose, a different approach in regards to assessing risk. And in doing that, he's actually going to be looking at using both fundamental stock level analysis along with quantitative type methods to actually assess future risk within small cap portfolios. With that, our presenter today, David Wannis, is the portfolio manager, as I mentioned, for our Australian Smaller Companies Fund. Just perhaps a little bit of background on David. He actually joined Schroders in February 2004. Prior to that, he was actually working with Morgan Stanley as an equity research analyst. He's actually held roles also with Merrill Lynch and Ord Minnett. His background is, well, I suppose, the sectors he's actually traditionally covered include healthcare, IT and investment services as well. So with that, if you can just give a very warm welcome to David. Thank you.
Thanks, David, and thanks everyone for coming to the session. My name's David Wannis. I am the Small Cap Portfolio Manager at Schroders, and wanted to talk about some of these issues around risk as it relates to small company portfolios and relative to some of the traditional ways that we've looked at risk as an industry, and sort of introducing some new methods or techniques that we think can give investors a better understanding of the risks that they're taking in the portfolios that they're investing in. I'm not intending to read through sort of all of these slides. You can probably read through them yourself. Some of you are probably up to slide 4 or 5 already in the pack. But what I wanted to sort of touch on this slide is just the traditional way of looking at risk in small company portfolios and the things that we're going to talk about today. And the three areas we're going to cover include looking at the benchmark itself, assessing whether or not the benchmark variability of diversification or riskiness changes over time. Secondly, we're going to look at how a fundamental or qualitative approach to risk at the sector level can give us some insights into ex-ante volatility. And then thirdly, we're going to drill further down to the stock level and look at methods that we might be able to use to implement a qualitative or fundamental risk approach into a traditional active management investment process. This slide's pretty simplistic and it takes us back to first principles, but it's worth reflecting on because it's always worth reminding ourselves what we're trying to do for investors and what we're trying to achieve. And the point here is that investors are looking for the highest risk-adjusted returns possible. It's not simply about higher returns that bring with it higher risk. It's about looking at both the return side of the equation and the risk side of the equation. And so as managers who are often looking to seek return opportunities, we do need to remain balanced and remain cognizant of the risk we're taking and ultimately to try and stay in the top left corner of that chart to deliver those superior risk-adjusted returns. So I know it's simplistic, but that graphic is really just to represent and remind ourselves what we're trying to achieve for investors. One of the methods that is used to try and control or reduce risk in portfolios is diversification. When we're talking about diversification, and you'll see in the presentation we look at sector diversification as the example, but it could be any number of factors. It could be size, liquidity, momentum, value, growth. There's lots of factors that influence portfolios that we're trying to diversify away from to try and control that risk. The issue when we're looking at relative risk measures is that there's an assumption embedded there that the benchmark itself is the lowest risk alternative. So that investors that are seeking very diversified portfolios are being measured against a benchmark which may or may not have that consistency of diversification that they're looking for. So what we've tried to do is look at what the benchmark looks like in a diversification sense, what our portfolio may look like, and whether or not the benchmark itself is changing its relative level of riskiness. Some examples are probably the best way to try and flesh this out, and we'll run through a few here to try and give this some depth. So what we're looking at here is the sector exposures on the right-hand side as at June 30 of the Small Ordinaries Accumulation Index. So that's the benchmark that we use in the small cap universe to compare our portfolios and be measured on a risk and return basis. It's showing the 10 top-level GICS sectors. So as I mentioned, this is a sector exposure we're looking at as this proxy for diversification. On the left, what we're looking at is that same 10-sector portfolio equally weighted with 10% of the portfolio in each of the sectors. Intuitively, looking at those two charts, you would make an assumption, I think most of us in the room would make an assumption, that the chart on the left is more diversified than the chart on the right. This can also be proven mathematically using what they call the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index. This is an index that was used by the Department of Justice in the US to measure antitrust concerns in merger acquisitions to understand whether or not industries are becoming overly concentrated, and as such, it's sort of been broadly applied in markets around the world. We've simply applied the HHI index or HHI score to these two portfolios to give us an objective and quantifiable measure of relative diversification. And in terms of how to measure those scores, the only thing really we need to know about with the HHI is that a higher score means that a universe, or an index in this case, is more concentrated or less diversified. And a lower score means that it's more diversified or less concentrated. So we do have an objective way of measuring relative diversification of factors, in this case the factor being the index sector weights. And we can potentially use that to measure portfolios against the benchmark and whether or not the benchmark concentration or diversification is changing over time. The other factor we have to deal with, though, is that the actual composition of the benchmark itself is changing in terms of those sector weights. So this chart breaks down to a lower level of GICS sectors. So we're looking now at 19 sectors. There's obviously a lot of other at the top there, with the larger sectors broken out. And so what this is showing is that picture that we looked at before, the pie chart at June 30, is a static view of what the index looks like today. But it's constantly changing. And as investors, maybe our decisions around tracking error should be considered in the context of how that's changing. So bringing those two factors together, the HHI score and the changing composition of the Small Ords Index, what we've done is run that score over time, the blue line being the HHI score for the Small Ords Index back to 1994. The scale on the left is slightly different because we've normalised for the different benchmarks we've looked at, but the concept is the same. The higher the HHI score, the more concentrated the index is. The lower, the more diversified the index is. And so we can see that the index character changes over time. There's periods of time, such as in the late 90s, when the index was very concentrated. If we go back a slide, you can see where that concentration resided in property, and there's another slide we can look at that will give us another view of that. And in 2002, 2003, the index was very diversified. So there was, you know, very few sectors that had material contribution to the index weight. So it gives us a view of what diversification looks like over time for the benchmark. And for investors that want a consistent level of diversification, it does suggest that simply holding benchmark weights will not give you that outcome. You will get changing levels of diversification because the benchmark itself is changing. To contrast that, we've also performed the same analysis on the top 100 stocks, which in general are more concentrated as a benchmark than the small odds. The reason being there's no exit valve, if you like, in the top 100. Sectors or companies that get too big for the small odds migrate into the top 100. Once you're there, if you're a big bank, if you're BHP or Rio, you stay there. So a lot of the concentration that exists in the top 100 stays there. The small odds is a lot more dynamic, and therefore we need to sort of monitor this, in our view, a lot more. The other example we've put on the slide is the MSCI All Countries World Index. So this is a very broad index of sectors around the world to try and highlight what a very broad definition of the market would look like, given the Small Ords is a very specialised benchmark. And it shows that at times it's more concentrated than the Small Ords, at times it's less, but the volatility of concentration is lower, albeit we don't have the same history of the time series. But our intuition would be that over time it would be lower because you're dealing with much broader indices in basically the world. This slide is another cut of the data we saw on the changing sector weights. The point here being, if we look today, and this is sorted or ranked by those sectors with the greatest weights in the Small Ords today, resources, energy and industrials are the top three by weight in the sector. But if you look at, you know, energy back in the mid-90s, it was a very small weight. And in the late 90s, or mid to late 90s, the property trusts were by far the largest weight in the Small Ords sector. So again, it's another cut of the same data to try and show that we're dealing with a moving target here. And the REITs, as they're now known, the listed property trust sector, is an interesting case in point to look at to give us sort of some insight into how fundamental risk analysis might help relative to the quantitative risk analysis. So this chart shows the volatility of the property trust index for 18 years, from 1988 to the end of 2006. Now, we've used the 200 property trust index, which obviously includes the larger stocks, because a lot of what was small cap listed property trusts have migrated into the top 100, and we're trying to get a continuous series to give us a lot of data to work with here. So what we're looking at is a sector whose volatility has remained relatively stable over that period of time. That's what the data sort of tells us as it relates to share price performances and volatility of share prices within the sector. But if we dig beneath that, if we look at qualitatively what was happening underneath the surface of the property trust index, they're two very different stories. So if you go back to the early 90s, when liquidity problems in wholesale trusts resulted in a lot of these companies listing and taking on LPT structures, you were dealing with an index of securities that were largely ungeared, domestically focused, most of their income coming from rental properties, and conservatively structured in a trust structure. Almost 20 years later, in late 2006, the data looks like not much has changed, but beneath the surface, it probably couldn't be different. You've now got, or you did have at the end of 2006, an index that was comprised of companies that were very leveraged. They had stapled structures, funds management businesses, on-balance sheet development, global property portfolios. They'd moved from being single sector specific to diversified across many sectors. And so fundamentally or qualitatively looking at the sector itself, our conclusion would have been, or was at the time, the risk profile ex ante is very different in late 2006 than it was in the early 90s, but the market really wasn't pricing it like that was the case. But eventually the real world does catch up to the data, and we saw what was considered an 18 standard deviation event as the volatility of the index, as the data itself, reflected the fundamentals of what was actually sitting behind it. So the leverage and the complex structures and the lack of transparency ultimately was priced by the market as being a very risky proposition. So that's an example of stepping down to the sector level of how we can apply our fundamental view of risk. We then try and go deeper than that and look at how can we apply this at the stock level and then build it into a process to make this part of what we do as active managers. And what I've got up on the screen there is a matrix of risk return activities in the traditional way that we see them in the market at the moment. So on the return side of things, there's quantitative and qualitative processes that are built around trying to extract returns and find alpha opportunities. On the risk side of the equation, though, there's a lot of quantitative methods, you know, value at risk and tracking error and Barron models and so on. There's very little that's done on the qualitative side. And so we think that in the same way that you can apply qualitative research to finding return opportunities, you can turn that same fundamental research effort, the analytical team, the process, to try to formalise and capture a qualitative view of risk, like the property trust example we just went through. If we look at how qualitative analysis targets returns at the moment, Everyone would be familiar with a lot of the items on this page. These are the questions that qualitative managers are looking to find answers to order the information and to embed into a portfolio to effectively get exposure to the alpha that they think they can generate from going through this process. And you know, all of you have seen many process documents that talk about different ways different firms go through that process to try and take qualitative information and embed it into a portfolio. To us, there's not a lot of difference in trying to answer the questions that relate to returns and ordering them and building them into a process than there is in doing the same for risk. The questions are different. And so if you think about it in a practical sense, if you have an hour with management to talk about their business, instead of spending 95% of the time trying to figure out how much money they're going to make and is there a return opportunity here, you might want to spend some of the time trying to answer the other questions on this slide. And so in the same way that we try and order the information and embed it into a portfolio from a return perspective, we think that there's the capacity to do the same on risk. And in fact, because fewer people spend time doing this, we think the opportunity to find extra risk-adjusted returns, if you like, could potentially be greater. So again, we'll drill down a bit deeper and try and give some examples of how we would go about doing this and indeed how we do go about doing this in looking at stocks in our universe of coverage. So this just fleshes out what we were talking about, some of the issues, some of the questions we'd look to get answers to. We've got stock A and stock B. Stock A is what we would consider a high-risk stock. Stock B, a lower-risk stock. So we're looking for answers to each of those questions, and we're looking to crudely score them. I mean, in theory, we could simply, it's not going to give us 3 decimal points of accuracy, but we could score corporate governance from 1 to 3, 1 being very poor because certain parts of their disclosure or the way they run their business we think are at the sort of low end of the scale, and 3 could be very good. And in that way, through each of these questions that we ask, each of these risk factors we're trying to identify and quantify, we can very crudely sum up all of the scores for each of those factors we're trying to identify. And so as a result, stock A would probably have a very low score relative to stock B, and we've given some examples that a lot of people in this room would be aware of, particularly in the stock A column, because they've got the column inches recently in the press, of how that risk does translate into real risk for shareholders, even well before the market had recognised it. A lot of the factors, a lot of the answers to those questions were there and were quite visible 2 years ago, not just 2 months ago when share prices dropped 90%. And so we'll go just one layer deeper and go through a practical example just to bring some of this alive. So what we've done is we've taken two of the companies on that list, ABC Learning and Technology One. They're both Queensland companies, so we're not being biased by state on this one. And we're going to run through a few of the objective things that we can look at and demonstrate the differences between what we think is a low-risk and a high-risk company, leaving aside some of the more subjective conclusions that we may come to. So this first chart looks at what we'd call quality of earnings, which is conversion of reported profits to free cash flow. A good business should, over time, convert around 100% of their reported profits into free cash flow. From year to year, it's not going to be perfect because accrual accounting and cash accounting are different. But by and large, you should see companies reporting similar cash earnings to reported earnings over time. We can see there for Technology One, that's been pretty consistent. There are years above, years below, but by and large, their cash earnings have reflected their reported earnings. For ABC Learning, there wasn't a single year in the past 6 years where their cash earnings were even positive relative to their reported earnings, let alone close to 100%, which is where you'd like to see it. So, you know, the first slide, the first piece of analysis, you know, 1 point to Technology One in being a lower risk stock on that basis. Yes, that's right. So the point is not that it should be 100% every year. It's that, so in 2006, Technology One's reported earnings were only 60% of cash earnings. is it transparent and really understandable to us as to why? Is there a good explanation? In the case of ABC Learning, you know, it was hard to find that good explanation. The second chart is talking about financial leverage. Again, a bit of a hot topic at the moment to sort of look at a proxy for risk that's there but not necessarily focused on all the time. And this is on balance sheet financial leverage. In this chart, less is more. So the higher the level of net debt to equity, the all other things being equal, the riskier it is to us as equity holders to invest in the equity of that firm. And so again, comparing ABC Learning to Technology One, there was a difference over time. ABC Learning's debt to equity did oscillate, but by and large, it was always quite material. Technology One, through the entire period, had a net cash balance sheet. So again, on the financial riskiness of the balance sheet, another point to Technology One versus ABC Learning. This chart also now includes off-balance sheet leverage. So committed operating leases, which don't show up on the balance sheet, but as equity holders, do give us insight into how much leverage the company has put in place. Makes a big difference to ABC Learning. They have a lot of off-balance sheet debt. Makes almost no difference to Technology One because the cash they have on the balance sheet is much greater than any of the obligations they've taken on in operating leases. So again, another view, another objective piece of data we can use, focusing on risk to suggest that there's some risk in ABC Learning that we need to be aware of. The final slide in sort of this series of comparing these two stocks on the fundamentals is shares on issue. Now, this is a bit of a proxy we're using for shareholder alignment. How management views shareholder equity in the issue of new shares is often reflective of how they treat equity capital, how scarcely they sort of value the capital they have in the business. And so, again, within the case of Technology One, they've actually reduced their share count through share buybacks over that period, so that in 2007, remaining shareholders have a greater share of the future profits of the business. ABC Learning, over the same period, increased their shares on issue by 400%. The interesting thing about that is not only did they increase the shares on issue by 400%, which raised a huge amount of equity capital, but they also still had a significant amount of leverage. So, you know, they were working the balance sheet pretty hard in their sort of quest for growth. And so ultimately, what does it come back to? It comes back to share prices. It comes back to investment performance. And there's three things that we think are pretty important to understand about looking at this share price chart in the context of what we've just talked about. The first is that we haven't talked, when we're looking at these share price charts, we haven't talked at all about returns, about PEs, about growth strategies, about, you know, the childcare's growing at X or technology's a risky business. All we focused on was the risk of each of those companies. The second point to note is that as an investor, if you were sitting there in late 2005 holding your Technology One shares, which have gone precisely nowhere in sort of 3 years, you'd be looking at the ABC Learning investor thinking, I've probably picked the wrong stock, they've made three times their money, you know, what have I been doing with my time? But ultimately, even though risk, as we're talking about it here, fundamental risk, does not show up in share prices on a daily or intraday or weekly basis, ultimately, that is the risk as investors that we are bearing by buying shares in a company with that sort of characteristic. And, you know, so in the short term, you might not see it. In the long term, I suspect ABC Learning shareholders or investors are probably less comfortable now than they were a couple of years ago. Just to close off on how we're using risk here, there is a valid argument that a lot of the risk estimation we're doing should be embedded in our valuation. It should be captured in the discount rate that we're using to discount the cash flow of each of those firms, and therefore our valuation on ABC Learning should have been significantly lower than the trading price, and indeed it was. But the issue we have is that as practitioners in the marketplace, the range of discount rates that are often appropriate is far wider than the range of discount rates that the market does actually apply. And so we think that at times taking the risk factors out of the valuation to be able to separately identify them rather than embed them into a single discount rate estimate and say we're done gives us more information to work with. It lets us understand the granularity of risks we're taking. So is a company risky because we don't like the corporate governance, or is it because it's leveraged? Or is it because that we don't think management have alignment of interest to shareholders? There's a number of different risks. And again, if we talk about diversification, we might be able to diversify away some of those risks. There could be stocks that have risky parts of their business, but the returns are adequate, and we want to make sure we're not doubling up on those risks. So again, if you look at a lot of the companies that are struggling at the moment, they're in different sectors, they're in different parts of the world, but there was a lot of concentration in risk around leverage and around conflict of interest in their business model. So again, we can use the information to construct more diversified portfolios. And that's really the sort of concluding point on bringing it back to portfolio construction. By undertaking this effort of understanding fundamental risks, of putting in place a process where we can capture some of the risk information that is often downplayed by the market or certainly not given the same weight as return information, we get that increased granularity of stock factors. We can start to look at optimising portfolios, looking at fundamental risks and fundamental return factors. And thirdly, we can then compare our view of qualitative risk with the traditional existing quantitative risk tools. So it's not seen as a replacement, it's seen as an augmentation of information that's already out there. So again, just wrapping up on the entire sort of presentation, the conclusions we came to in our study was that the diversification and riskiness of the benchmark is not fixed. Investors can inadvertently create less diversified portfolios at points in time by adhering to benchmark weights, and as such, taking on tracking error at times when the index itself is more concentrated might indeed be a way of reducing risk. History is not prologue when looking at sector risk. We need to understand why. And using our qualitative risk framework can augment those existing quantitative methods. And again, reminding all of us that the ultimate goal for investor portfolios is better risk-adjusted returns, not just better returns. Thank you.
No? It is better. Okay, the next format, we're going to question and answer sessions, and we'll start with Van Eyck Research, who will ask a question to commence. I think it might be best if you took this and spoke into it, given that your voice might not travel to the back. You haven't noticed my squint yet, have you?
Hello, well, it's nice to see people thinking not just about relative risk, but also about absolute risk in portfolios. But I guess, can you see a day when we could come up with a qualitative framework to incorporate into portfolio guidelines at the aggregate level, or will it always just be sort of used to shock test and sort of at the, I guess, at the stock level?
I think we can. The idea behind what we're trying to do is to be able to aggregate up a lot of what we're doing to the portfolio level. But like the qualitative return process that many active managers employ, I don't think there's a universal answer. I think, you know, each manager has to determine what they think drives return or risk, how they capture that information, and then how they feed it up. But I think that without feeding up stock level risk to the portfolio level, you start to lose a lot of the value of the information you've gone and captured. So I'm not sure if that answers the question.
Do you know, maybe just a follow-up. How would you try to, try to convince people that they need to do this? And, you know, can you think of ways where you can start to empirically test some of your risk factors and, you know, how that's helped your portfolio?
I think, we've put a slide at... Oh, I've gone maybe too far. There's a slide at the end which does show, you know, how we try and present some of our returns. So we look at the standard deviation of return of our fund versus the benchmark. We do try and measure it. We're trying to talk more about measuring risk when we talk about relative performance of funds. One of the problems with a forward-looking fundamental qualitative approach is it's very hard to go and back test, you know, to say, well, let's go and sit back in 2006 and say, what would we have done? Because you lose some of the rigour and the human biases that you have in a qualitative framework. So I think it's about demonstrating to people that in practice we can lower risk and talking about our process and highlighting why we think people should be asking the question. And if people don't think we should be asking the question about stock level risk, then that's fine. We're willing to listen to that. It's really just about moving the debate, I think.
If I just split my small caps portfolio into each sector evenly, would I A, outperform the index, the small caps index, and B, would I outperform Schroders?
It's an interesting question. We haven't run the numbers. On your first question, I suspect the answer is no. In fact, I'm pretty depending on what time period you're looking at, and the reason being, and one of the, you know, the real live issues that we're focusing on at the moment, is that materials and energy, which by constructing the portfolio on the left, you would be meaningfully underweight, have been the significant driver of performance. So in that case, no. Relative to us, it depends. I'd have to run that for you, but probably not.
I'm here to tell you nobody outperforms Schroders. Not in this session anyway. Another question.
Go ahead. Where does this analysis fit in the total screening process? Because harking back to your 2006 issue, where materials at that time might be seen as a sector that's going to be advantaged by what's coming down the line. Mm.
So, I mean, the materials one is interesting, and we are underweight materials in our portfolio. So we have, through a risk lens, looked at the opportunities in that part of the market. The fund's only been running since December 2007, so we don't sort of have what would our view have been 2 years ago. But we have been underweight, and the reason is because we do think they're very risky. There's a lot of operating leverage in these businesses. So put aside, you know, what you think about China and India and all the big macro thematics, and I mean, you know, whether or not people think they have an information advantage on these things. When we looked at the risk of the businesses, they're extremely high risk. I mean, we looked at them as recently as a week ago when, you know, nickel stocks had gone down 75% to try and understand, is there an opportunity here? They're, in our view, in a fundamental view of those businesses, they have a lot of operating leverage risk. It's different to the risk that people are focused on now, you know, high levels of leverage, financial engineering, complex business models, but nonetheless there is risk there. So that's how it feeds in at the moment into our process. We have valuations on these stocks, and we're trying to understand now, given the upside is significantly more than it would have been 6 months ago, are we being compensated for that risk yet? So that's a real live sort of issue we're going through at the moment, because it's not to say you never invest in a risky stock, it's just that the return has to be commensurate with that. I'm not sure if that answered the question.
What do you mean by the difference between operating leverage and financial leverage?
So in a business with a lot of financial leverage is one that has a lot of debt. Because you've got a lot of debt in your business, very small changes in the operating environment mean very large changes to returns to equity holders, because there's a huge amount of interest payment that needs to be made. Property trusts are a prime example of this. No, operating leverage, so you could then take an ungeared business that has no debt whatsoever, and very small changes in the drivers of their business, in the case of mining companies, it's commodity prices, cash costs, CapEx, can have significant changes on the earnings of the business. So they're different factors. It's not related to their financial gearing. It's related to the nature of the business they're in. And that's why, you know, the risk would be almost untenable in a mining company that had a lot of financial leverage as well, because you're amplifying both of them.
How do these qualitative factors reconcile with your ex-ante portfolio process in times of conflict? I mean, how do they come together? I would have actually thought if you're really managing risk, particularly on the financial leverage operation risk, the alpha in the recent period would have been a lot more significant than 3.5. So I'm just trying to understand how they come together and what drives that.
So in terms of our performance, the single biggest influence in the portfolio has been our underweight materials position. So, you know, it's a 6 or 7 month period where our view of risk, and think about the length of that ABC Learning example, in a 6 or 7 month period, our view of risk wasn't shared by the market. And so by being underweight the part of the market that went up significantly, you know, we were quite a fair bit under the market if you went back to May or June. As that's changed, the performance has changed. So,
how would the performance have altered if you excluded that resource sector, which is focused on industrial?
Have you done the numbers? Not recently, but very well. So, I mean, that was the big... So versus the industrial market, we've done extremely well. Versus, and so the influence of that one sector bet has been the biggest influence on the portfolio. So how does it feed in? The if you look at traditional growth factors and resource stocks are now considered growth stocks because their performance has been good and their current ROEs are high. Their share price performances are still pretty volatile, so I don't suspect too many models would call them low risk. But I suspect we may get a difference in opinion. And at least when we're taking the view, we have the difference and we know why we're taking the view. We're not just saying we're going to be underweight resources. We're going to be underweight resources because the risk-adjusted returns on our modelling are not appropriate. I think a lot of the factors are universal. You know, there's a universal factors of looking at risk within businesses. Small cap companies, you know, almost by definition, are less diversified, have probably more reliance on management to make sort of decisions. So you might weight the factors differently. You know, your management alignment of interest or, you know, the amount of leverage that the company takes on because of that lack of internal business diversification might mean that you focus on them differently. But by and large, in the same way as seeking returns, you're trying to understand the same list of things, big cap or small cap, I think the lists are similar, the weighting's a bit different. And it's not an exhaustive list, by the way. This is something that over time, you know, we learn from and we change, and like any business, like any sort of market, you need to be aware of different risks that emerge, different trends that are emerging on the return and the risk side. So that was really an example of a number of things we're looking at, but over time the list does tend to grow.
Picking up on a comment in the last session that the one group that should do better than the rest going forward are the entrepreneurs. The population of entrepreneurs, you would think it's higher in small caps. So do you have the kind of screening process that might be able to capture that likelihood if it eventuates?
Yeah, so we... one of the things we do when we look at stocks, we try and use our own assessment of what type of opportunity it is. And so there are a lot of what we would call speculative opportunities, whether they're industrial companies, technology companies, small junior mining companies. And so we're aware of the type of risks that relate to a speculative venture. You can make multiples of your money and you can lose everything. And so what we try and do is, again, from that diversification perspective, say we don't want 50% of the portfolio in speculative entrepreneurial type opportunities, and you know we want to find out of that universe that shares that risk characteristic, we want to find the best ones we can. So they do exist in this part of the market much more than they do in the top 100, and we are willing to, again, apply our research to that and try and find the best risk-adjusted returns in that universe, bearing in mind that they share that characteristic, which is very different to a mature retailing business or, you know, a general industrial business. So, yep.
Change of the rules. We have to complete the next 10 minutes, so with regrets, I'll only be able to take one more question, just so we complete the question answer part and give Caitlin a response and you write a reply.
So, David, you mentioned that this risk framework leads you to a relatively negative view on materials currently. What are the sectors that you prefer currently looking through this risk framework and why?
So there's two sides to that. One is there a sector preference that we have? And the second is there a characteristic preference we have? At the moment, dealing with the characteristic preference, we're focusing on companies with low levels of financial risk, with very strong operating cash flows. So regardless of sectors that they're in, we're trying to find the best companies in each sector, strong competitive advantages, you know, good alignment of interest with shareholders. very transparent business models that we can understand how they make money, given a lot of the complexity that's been going on. If we then went and said, what sectors is that leading us into? Technology, there's some interesting opportunities in that space. Healthcare, we have some, so we're overweight the healthcare sector. So going at it from a characteristic perspective, you know, finding those leaders has led us to those sectors at the moment. Thanks.
Thanks, Ian. It's my role to let you know that obviously we do have an Australian Smaller Companies Fund. As David said, we actually launched the fund in December 07. We've been in the process of talking to all the research houses. We've already received a highly recommended rating from Morningstar, and there are additional research ratings hopefully due out fairly soon. We're in the process of talking to platforms, so if you have any interest in an Australian Smaller Companies Fund, please actually speak with the Schroders team that are actually here at the PC Forum, Ray Macken, who's our research manager, Bob Holloway, our business development manager, and myself. We'd be more than happy to ask or answer any questions. Thanks.
Thanks, David. Okay, let's get to the fun part with the question and answers. SIM cards into the gizmos. Isn't that a lovely name, gizmo? You're allowed to leave the room if you want to, David. Well, you can stay. Okay. That's right. It's a little bit like Idol, isn't it? Australian Idol. This session was awful, mediocre, good or excellent. If you would press now. Thank you. Time's up. Okay. That's good. All right. The results of that will be communicated later on in the day. And for those of you that want to come back for the session for further extension of this, you'll be invited again later in the afternoon. What I'd like to do is just pass over in the last 2 or 3 minutes to Caitlin Ruddock from Van Eyck. I probably misrepresented her position. By way of background, she has a doctorate and from the University of New South Wales was a lecturer there as well. Currently with Van Eyck, who undoubtedly feel a bit cheesed off that they haven't given a rating to that as quickly as Morningstar. So over to you.
Well, we are actually currently doing our small caps review, so hopefully we'll be able to give you some results very soon. But I thought what was pretty important to, you know, think about today, obviously there's been a lot of carnage in the small caps space, which makes it really interesting. It's not just about stock picking, but also I think about how managers think about risk and understanding, you know, what their bets are and how they combine that in a portfolio. And I guess they're the two key things we're looking at in our review: stock picking abilities and that portfolio construction. It's really critical in the small caps. There's lots of challenges to do. I think tactically at the moment, Van Eyck has been underweight small caps given the headwinds with high inflation, the economy, etc. But in general, our strategic asset allocation is to increase the allocation to small caps. And I think we've gone from 10% of the portfolio of Australian equities up to 19%. Strategically, and I think that's to do with some of the points raised here about trying to identify those entrepreneurial and get exposure to that and that growth, obviously in a risk-adjusted way, and you know, to plan for your retirement, etc. So, you know, certainly we recommend having about two managers, and hopefully we'll give you the Van Eyck rating soon, so you can put those managers into your portfolios if they're not already there.
Thank you, Caitlin, and we'll watch the blueprint with interest during the next year as well, I guess. Okay, that completes the session. Thank you, everybody. I think we just move to the next one, and there'll be a 10 or 15 minute gap. Thank you for your time.
Do we leave the gizmos here?
Yeah, leave the gizmos if you would.